time. Hi, my name is Jim, and I am an alcoholic.
Thank
you for having me down here, Billy. Thanks for asking me to speak. Doug, thanks for driving down and keeping me company. The ego that I had coming down here, I figured if we were in a car accident, I could just see the headline, two alcoholics involved in a car accident. You know, I'm thinking to myself, goodness gracious, resentment right after, you know, third step prayer set right after that. You know, my sobriety date is August 10, 2004. My home group is Hope is Here, if you're up in Northern Virginia, on Tuesday nights, standard drunk time at 8:30. It's a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for people that want to get sober. I do have a sponsor. I do sponsor men in this program. My sponsor has a sponsor, and he has a sponsor, so it goes pretty deep into the way we do things up north and basically everywhere I've been and asked to speak. I'd like to say that it was a troubling background that I came from. We were talking about inner child earlier. It had nothing to do with it. It was all me. It was a mess from the very get-go. My parents, just to get it out of the way, I'm 46 years old. I didn't get sober, obviously, until my early 40s. Had lots of fun in between. Had lots of fun drinking. You know what? But I just didn't know when the fun stopped and the trouble started, because it's one big blur. But I can remember being kind of a troublesome little kid even when I was little. My parents had me kind of late in life. My mother and father are from New England, and somehow we ended up in California. So my father was in the military, and I was their firstborn child, and I was the golden child. I was the first. I was God's gift to them, and they treated me as such. And I can remember the first piece of rebellion I had was about 3 or 4 years of age, and it looks like this crowd will, you know, I can say this to you, and it's not my parents being abusive or anything, but they said, "We're going to Virginia." And I said, "No, I'm not." And they said, "Yes, you are." And I said, "No, I'm not." And my father said, "Fine." And he quickly got in the car and drove off. Now, you're 3 or 4 years old, and you can do this, you know, in the 60s. You know, I thought it was like a day. But he just drove around the block, came back around, and said, "Do you want to go to Virginia?" And I said, "I certainly do." And I got into the car, and off to Virginia we came. When we got out here, normal childhood. I mean, it was the white picket fence. It was little brother, little sister. Mother and dad loved each other. Nice Catholic upbringing. Not a thing that says, future alcoholic, look out. It was just absolutely me that was there. My parents, it was made very clear early in life where I fell in the ranking of the family. My dad said to me, "I love your mother. I love your mother first. I love you, but your mother comes first and always will." So I understood where we were with that. And that's how we grew up. We knew that. There was no doubt my parents loved us, but we knew how it would work. There was no running to mom if dad said no. That wasn't a good thing. But we just, from the very get-go, it was a very loving, loving household. The only difference was that coming up through a Catholic education, as we went to church, I heard a different message. I sat between my mother and my father, my sister and my brother, and they heard this loving God that would take care of them no matter what. And I heard, "This guy wants to kill me." Because the things I think about when I'm not in church are not good. And basically the priest was there telling me that. You can't have these kind of thoughts. You shouldn't have these types of things. My dad was my hero, without a doubt. My father was my little league coach, football coach. He was everything I thought a man was supposed to be. You know, when I was little, I didn't know what those sacrifices meant when he would leave to come up to get to a 5 o'clock practice, meaning that he'd have to leave his job. Didn't know what that was doing to his career, but he thought it was more important to see a 6-year-old or 7-year-old play baseball. And we all know what a pleasure that can be. Even in football, and all these things that they did, all these sacrifices. And my mom is making those same sacrifices for my sister. And all these things are going on in our life, but and our idea of a good weekend I love this weather because it reminds me of growing up, is we would go out on a Saturday and Sunday and we'd just get our chores done. We'd rake the leaves, do whatever we had to do. And this was the old days where to get rid of the leaves, you just threw like half a gallon of gas on them, threw a match, and you had yourself a bonfire. And that was semi-legal back then. But then we'd come back inside, and my father couldn't think of a better afternoon than having a bologna and mustard sandwich with a Schlitz beer. That was his afternoon. Now, his idea of a heavy drinking afternoon would be maybe two. But what I started out was, I was his gopher guy. And I would make a sandwich and go get his beer, and I did that one thing that said, can I have a sip? And I had that first sip. And, you know, I don't know, most people I run into don't like beer too much. From the get-go, I liked beer. I said, this is good stuff. So when my father would have a little bit more than normal, it was because I was having a little bit more than normal as I was bringing it to him. He's like, you know, next time you get one, don't take your sip. And I go, okay, Dad, I understand. But this is how it worked. This is how it all worked in my house. That did not make me alcoholic either. That had nothing to do with what I was going to do later in life. By the time I was in the ninth grade, my uncle passed away. I did not know him very well. He was on my father's side. So my father decided to load up my little brother, who was 3 and a half at the time, and mother and father, drive to New York and leave us here as he went to bury his brother. On the way back down from Connecticut, my brother was killed in a car accident. He was sucked out of the back of a Pinto in a freak accident. And all I can remember was it's the first time I seen my father cry. And I saw him in this pain. And I saw him hurt. And I've never seen this happen. Not the man that would just stand up and be all these things. And all he did was cry, by the way. But what it started for me was it was okay to start to drink a little bit. Because that calmed the nerves a little bit. So now, what's really, there's changes going on now. Now I'm starting to drink, not because it tastes good, but because it's having to start the effect. And now I'm looking to start stealing the beers from my father and all these things. And, you know, and the other piece to it is, this is when I started to get that feeling about God was being validated. Okay? What's this little kid done? He never hurt anybody. Why did you kill a little kid when you got me thinking the way I think already, wanting to do the things I want to do already, and you take him out? So I know I've got a God that wants to hurt me. So I'm going to hide from him. I'm going to hide. That's my best idea. I'm going to hide from God. I don't know if you ever tried it. It tends not to work. So we're coming through life here, and I have my true first drunk. And I have to tell you, I do not like hard liquor. I never liked hard liquor. I did this all on my own with beer. I mean, I did it good. We'll get to that. But my first real good drunk was a whole bottle of Old Granddad. And me and my buddy, Rocco Edivan, and his girlfriend, Christina, not the one you know, decided that we were going to drink that bottle. And the first time I took a sip, I said, oh, this is terrible. Give me some more. And where we were going was, we were going to a Little League game, or actually my school's baseball game. And we had time to take the bike trail up through Northern Virginia. We're drinking the whole way. And I had the pitching rules said I could not play the next game. So I knew I wasn't going to play. So this was perfect. But God's got a sense of humor. And so when I get there with my first big buzz from Old Granddad, the coach said, Jim, don't have enough players. You need to play right field. So, you know, right field in a Little League game, even at, you know, eighth grade level, pretty safe place to be. Nothing comes that way. Not this day, because God loves Jim. Everything is coming out, like in sixes. I mean, you know, I'm trying to figure out which one to catch, which one to throw back, and God knows what. You know, they're like, Jim, you can come in now. That was 3 outs. Well, nah, just stay out here. It's easier. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that. And having said I came from California, I also came and I was put 1 year back. And this became important when I started drinking in high school because I was one half year older than the rest of the kids. And this is going to be very, very beneficial, by the way. In my senior year, with all the drama that was going on with our family, with the death of my brother, my father started showing signs of having an illness himself. And in my senior year, he died of Hodgkin's disease from cancer. And so, being the trending towards the good alcoholic that I was going to be, I didn't even really feel that, I don't know, you know, I know I missed my father, but I was more interested in I could drink. Because everyone said it was okay. They said, you can drink. And matter of fact, they would bring the beer in the house. And I was just turning 18, and up there at that time, 18 was the drinks, and this made it good with all my friends. And I was becoming popular, and I was getting to do the things I wanted to do that I know God didn't want me to do now, too. I was becoming very popular with a lot of people up there because of the tragedy in Jim's life, and all I wanted to do was to drink and have a really, really good time and not have any consequences to the things that were happening. And I wouldn't say I was an everyday drinker at that point, but the weekends, it was on. And if you were going to drink with me, and I was going to pay for it, because it was my ID, you were going to pay for me. So the first person that got paid off was me. So I get my beer off the top, and whatever was left over was yours. And I loved drinking your beer, too, because that's what I do. That's how it was. And here I am now, my hero is also dead. Put in the ground, and he's dead. And all I can think about is, thank you, God. Thank you, God, for taking something else away. Because now I got nothing. I'm sitting there all by myself, and I've got nothing. But you know what? It's always worked out before. You know, because I'm self-dependent. I know what I'm doing. You just give me some alcohol, and I'll be just fine. It works. Every answer was solved with alcohol for me. It made the bills go away because you just threw them away. You know, you drank, you know, pay rent? No, because that would cut into the alcohol. You know, you start creative bill paying. You put the gas bill in with the rent bill went somewhere else, you don't sign the check. And this is the end of the day, oh, you've done it, good, I'm glad I'm not by myself. There's always one in the back row that goes, yeah, I did that. The Jim Branch bill paying method. And you could always float that check through until it cleared because, you know, the bank never caught up to it for 3 or 4 days, so you could always run it a couple through. Yeah, you know, after a while they start getting wise to your scams, but hell, I didn't care. About this time, it seemed to be the responsible thing to do would be to get a job because, you know, mommy was tired of giving me money, so you might as well get a job. And I found a job that I liked. It involved some travel in it, and there are a lot of women in it, in the field. So it's just like, oh, women drinking money. Good. This is a good thing. This is a good start. I like this. And at the time, I had what I call an in-and-out girlfriend. Anytime there was trouble, she was in. Anytime there wasn't trouble, she was out. And basically, we knew each other from about kindergarten on, and she was always there. So about this time, I got myself into a little situation where my friends were getting married, and it looked like a good idea, and she wasn't doing anything, and I wasn't doing anything, so we thought, why not get married? You know, everyone else is doing it, so why not? And Doug and I were talking about it on the way down. Men and women seem to have a different idea how to live, and her and I definitely were on a different page from the absolute get-go. She wanted me to work hard and advance in a career. I wanted to drink. And those were normally not compatible. Yeah, the interesting part is I never lost a job when I drank. Except because that was just me being very talented. But I do know I wanted to make more money. So when I had this great job that I had a couple choices to make. I could go get a part-time job, and that cuts into your drinking. And I could work harder, and that was just harder. So I wasn't going to do that. And then there was this other option, which is called stealing. And stealing seemed to work. Because no one really got hurt. You know, my intentions, by the way. I want you all to judge me on my intentions, not what I do. Because, you know, my intentions make me a great guy. Now, what I do doesn't make me a great guy. I intend on paying you back. Maybe not in the timetable that you want, but my idea when I start taking the money from you is that I will pay you back. Don't know how, but that's my intention. I haven't done that yet. Now, when you start stealing the way I was stealing, because, you know, if you're going to steal, don't steal small, steal big. You got to go big. And so every conversation with the door closed in my manager's office was, of course, about me, because nothing goes on here without me. Everything spins around me. And so I just saw all these people being run in and out of their office, and I just know that they're talking about me and my stealing. And so finally got my turn to be called into the office. And my boss sits me down and says, I have something that I have to tell you that's going to affect your career. And for some reason I stopped and I said, okay, maybe he doesn't know. And he said, well, I got pulled over and I had a DWI charge against me and a DUI charge against me. So I'm going to be going to Alcoholics Anonymous at lunch in the afternoon. And that's where I'm going to be during the afternoon. Well, I had this great idea, and it was right then and there. I said, well, I've been stealing from you, and I'm also alcoholic. So, you know, I've had a little bit of history with AA. He's been sober for about an hour now. And I said, well, there's my first sponsor, the guy with the hour of sobriety. So I'm figuring, you know, he'll have a little compassion. He knows how it is to have a rough time in life, and he bought it. So every afternoon, we both went over to the AA meetings. And, you know, we come up with a plan to pay back. Now, what I liked about this, my first little stint through AA, was you didn't have to do anything. You just had to show up when this guy who I'm paying back the money, who's motivated me, and the fire starts going away. Never telling my wife, by the way, why the funds are, you know, check. Oh, honey, I don't know. You just shorted me. He'll make it up on my next check. Okay, sure. You know, all those little lies at home, you know. Hard even to keep track of all the lies that I've told. It's like, okay, which one on this paycheck is she going to believe? You know, wonderful woman. Not real bright, but a wonderful woman, because she believed every one of those tales that I would tell. And as I'm going through this, and we get this method put away, this whole thing done, and the heat's off, I start seeing other things in AA that I like. People not doing the work. Finding out where the parties are after the meeting. Finding that other people that are like me in those meetings that aren't particularly interested in sobriety, just interested in passing their time through until the heat's off. And that's exactly what I did. I sat there, found the parties, found the people who wanted to party, and next thing you know, the meetings were not as necessary, and I was right back out of the fix again, doing all those things that, you know. And the really funny part to this was, I stopped drinking for that short period of time, but when I started back up again, I went right back to where I was, without a doubt. Because I guess I turned professional or something. Because now I can drink as much as I ever did, and I'm going for it at this point. And then about this time, I had another great idea. I woke up, and I looked at my wife, and I said, you know this isn't working. And she said, I know. I said, well, I think we should divorce. And I was married for 7 years, two of them happily, not consecutively, not all at the same time. But I said, I don't want to be married anymore. And she said, that's fine. So I went and got my luggage. I went and got 2 Glad bags, and I stuffed all the clothes I had in the Glad bags. I asked her which car that she wanted. She took the better of the two. And I went downstairs, and I had another great idea. So I called my boss up, and I said, I don't like working for you anymore. And I quit my job. All in about a matter of an hour and a half. So I'm sitting downstairs with my green luggage, my old car, jobless, and not knowing what I'm going to do. So, again, being very smart and hating this guy that made me quit the job, run out of the house that we're paying for. I know my buddy is down in the Outer Banks building a house, and he asked me, wants some help. So what do I do? Without a phone call, nothing, I drive 7 hours to Avon, North Carolina. If you've been to the Outer Banks, that's past Nagshead. That's like, you know, you miss Avon, you're driving right into the Atlantic Ocean. You'll end up in Spain before you hit another part of the United States. And I get to Avon, and he's working on a house. And then I said, Brian, I just quit my job. And he's like, sounds good. Just divorced my wife. That's really good. Can I work here for you? He said, I can't pay you a whole lot. Room and board, some spending money. You help me with the house. I said, okay. Now, the one nice part about that was Brian did not know how I drank, though. And room and board became very expensive for Brian because I considered my alcohol part of the room and board plan. So, you know, and that was an every night gig, by the way. And I'm not just like lightweighting it at this point. I'm doing somewhere between 16 and 18 beers a night to maintain. But I'm not a morning drinker, by the way. I do this after work. And somehow we're able to get up and go to work. Now, I'm convinced that they probably did not get my best effort on that house down there either. I'm convinced there's some duct tape where there should be some nails. I'm not too sure there isn't some load-bearing duct tape down there. And every time the Weather Channel comes on and you see a hurricane go through, I'm like, don't go through Avon. Please don't go through Avon. Because I'm convinced that house is going to be picked up and like put in Norfolk somewhere, you know, because it wasn't Brian's fault, but that was my grand plan. Well, you know, eventually when you're only building one house, you don't have anything else to do. And since Brian was out of a job, that meant I was out of a job, which was very, very inconsiderate on his part, and started resenting him more. So, you know, I do what every man does when the going gets rough. He moves back in with mommy. That's what you do. You find out that your wife, I created all these problems with my wife. When I said found out, she was protecting herself against me, which she shouldn't be doing. And she had put the money away. We had wrote the divorce decree where her side of the column said everything and mine said nothing. And I signed off on that because that's what I wanted. Because in that column, I really saw I can drink the way I want. You know, when you see your dog listed on a divorce piece of paper, and just for your edification, it says dog, Petey. Like, you forget your own dog's name. You know, you're pretty much done at that point. Come back north. I move back in with my mom. She says, well, I'm not supporting you either. You got to go get a job. And I do say thank God today, because now I got to do something for myself. And this bright orange hardware company was just opening up in Northern Virginia. Never been in Virginia in their entire lives. And they were looking for stupid people to work for them. Well, I was the stupidest one I knew, and I said, okay, let's go. And I walked into that place, and I said, I'm here to work for you. They said, what do you know about hardware? I said, I know enough to close the wrench before you use it as a hammer. They said, that'll be $8.50 an hour, or you start tomorrow. I said, okay, off we go. But what I liked about them is they drank just like I did. We're building stores, and you know, this probably is an OSHA violation, but we would bring the pallets in with a keg on the top. And the people that were working the upper rack, it was just easier to lift it up there and let them get their own beer and bring it out the store. So that was a good thing. Now, with a company that had some growth the way this one did, they were promoting anybody. And that included me. So, I mean, I've been there long enough. By the way, if you had time in service, you were promoted because you did the things they wanted you to do. And eventually, somehow, I ended up being a store manager. running programs like Building Better Health. You know, I'm drinking every night, and I'm talking about eating carrots the next day. The carrots are good. You know, I'm fooling them, too. I'm absolutely fooling them every day. I know I am. Just like we fooled everybody. You know, my boss would come in and go, why are you making yourself sick again? And I'm not even getting it. You know, I'm not even getting it. So one day, just kind of try to speed up, because I do get sober in this story somewhere. But one day, I thought I was having a heart attack. And I was in store, and I have 170 people working that day. And I'm having a hard time. Absolutely convinced. Had nothing to do with the 24 beers the night before, no food. But I'm having a heart attack. So we call Fairfax County, their emergency service people. And they come running up there, and they just throw you in the back. They go, my God, looking at you, I'm red. My blood pressure is shooting through the roof. I'm dying. I'm having a heart attack. I had a heart attack. And, you know, you sit in the back of that ambulance, and you're taking these people's time and their care, and they take you to Fairfax Hospital. And up in Fairfax, that's like one of the most amazing emergency rooms there is. Their heart center is like top-notch, the whole nine yards. But it's when I started learning emergency room etiquette. Because as I'm laying in my nice little cubicle, and they're all being nice to me, making sure that I'm getting better, they start realizing that I'm not having a heart attack. One of them is I'm breathing okay. Okay, and my blood pressure is coming down. So I'm just having an anxiety attack. But when I hear that, you get taken out of your nice little cubicle, and you're moved to the wall. Okay? And you'll sit on the wall until they tell you you can go. That could be days, it could be hours, could be there's still people against that wall. And then they start moving you down the hallway until eventually you're on Gallows Road at the bus stop, ready to get your ride home. Well, you know, not fully convinced that it wasn't a heart attack, I had to go find my general practitioner and spend some time with her. And we had to rule out all the problems I was having. Through the list. Are you drinking? Just a couple beers a night. Yeah, a couple beers a night. Yeah, my couple, yeah. I had a plan on that, by the way, when she said, you should really, I think you are drinking more than that. And so, and I got to show this to Doug so he has a validation on this. I went to bigger glasses. And just would pour two beers into one big glass. Because that would cut my beer drinking down in half. Because I counted by the glass. It makes sense to me. That's good alcoholic math, by the way. Oh, by the way, I got carried out of this Big Orange hardware store twice more. And by the third time you called emergency, they're no longer very nice about it. They basically don't even stop the thing. They just open up the back door. They said, get in, put your probes in, what's your blood pressure at? They're not even getting out of the front seat anymore. You know, you're just sitting there. And then they stop at Fairfax Hospital, they roll you in, they leave. And so, at this point, I'm going, this isn't right. There's got to be something more to this. And I don't know what it is. Because there's only one thing that works in my entire life, and that's alcohol. It works on all my problems. You know, this time of year is kind of always interesting. Because I hated it. I hated this time of year. Because I didn't know how long I had to spend with my mother and my sister and her family. I mean, how long did I have to stay in the house before it was appropriate to leave? I mean, could I just go over there, grab a plate, and leave? Could I have like a drive-up window of turkey? I thought I want to spend time with them, and they don't want to be there. I know that. No one's told me that, but I know. As soon as I walk in the house, all the conversation stops. And I know they're talking about me again, like it's always been. And how it's going to be in another month. And as soon as I left and I got what I needed, got the medicine I needed, I'd be thinking, why don't they want me there? You know, and this is, again, their problem, not mine. And I'd go home to that one-bedroom apartment knowing that, you know, I'm a manager at a big, successful place. But really, when I'm alone by myself, and I do mean by myself because there's only me and the committee in my head that's having this meeting upstairs that I'm not even invited to. And it's just talking away, you know. It's like, shut up. And you're just drinking over it, and it's just me. That's not a good thing. And for one moment, I guess, kind of lucidly, I said, maybe it is something else. Maybe it is the alcohol. And I started writing down all the good times, because if it's going to be alcohol, I needed to remember them. Because I'm sure that once, if I do get sober, the good times are over. They're done. They'll be selling flowers at the airport. I know this is what's going to happen when I go back. And I remember what AA was like. You all didn't help me. You didn't shake my hand. You didn't do anything for me, if that's what the cause is going to be. I had spent quite a bit of Blue Cross and Blue Shield's money already. As a matter of fact, I went so far with the heart attack game that they did an angiogram, which is a testing to make sure that you don't have any clogged veins. And I came out perfectly healthy. And I'm like, oh, good, this is great. So it's got to be the one thing I don't want it to be, and it's got to be the alcohol. So I looked at the calendar, and since I wasn't working, it was clear. And I went into Fairfax County Detox for the 7-day, 5-day spin dry. And I have to tell you that in detox, AA is so much easier because there's only 3 steps and you wrote them out. You were forgiven and they fed you for free. They made, you know, they put you to bed at night. They wake you up at 2 o'clock in the morning to make sure you're sleeping. And they give you more medication. And I'm like, this is good. I can do this kind of sobriety. And what was happening there is they got me physically sober, which was probably the worst thing that could happen. Because you take away what makes me at least tolerable for my head. You take away the alcohol and you leave me with me. That's a freaking mess. Because now all I got to do is think about myself. And that's all I got. And I've got nothing to stop the crap that's in my head. All those nasty ideas that I have, all those things, and I have no way to make them stop. But while I'm in the detox, they said, well, you know, one of the things you need to do is go get a sponsor. So, a sponsor? I said, okay, because I want to score high in detox, by the way. I want to be the best of the best of the detox people. So I go to the meeting that they have. They bring into the hospital. I can't even go to a meeting. They bring the meetings to you. So, I mean, you got to love AA when they're bringing the meetings to you. It's a good thing. And so I'm sitting in the front row. Saw that I was way too close and moved to the back row. And the guy that was running the meeting walked up to me and said, can you read this? And I got my first resentment. Does he mean, can I read this or will I read this? And I said, I'll read it for you. And it was how it works. And I read it through, and I'm like, oh, my goodness gracious. And after the meeting, he came up to me, said, my name is Jim. Let me tell you about myself. And I said, oh, great. This is working out great. All I want to do is go upstairs and go to bed. And he said, well, I'm a retail manager, but I'm not doing that anymore. Now I'm a security guard. And I said, you're an AA? He goes, yeah. And I said, oh, this is working out for you. My trust has been repossessed. I'm going, and then you're an AA? I'm going, this is really great. My wife just kicked me out of my house. I don't think I'm going to get custody of my kids, and I've never been happier. And I went, oh, you've got to be kidding me. And I looked at him. I said, I needed one. I said, do you want to be my sponsor? He said, okay. Because when I looked in his eyes, though, they were a lot clearer than mine. He meant what he said. He actually said, when he said that all this crap that was going on that I wouldn't tolerate, he meant, I'm getting through all this stuff. And he was doing it, just on a daily basis. And he said, you can have this too. And I go, no. Because I looked up and I saw your steps and that second word, that second step in there, it had that word in there. And he's not taking me back. There's no way. Because he wants to kill me. And I thought, are you part of the plan to get me in this thing? Change me over to God and then God kills me? He says, go ahead and walk across the Chesapeake Bay, and then he'll part him, and that's how I thought about it. I said, no, that's not how we do it. And we started talking more and more about getting sober and the things that I had done in sobriety, where I didn't think I had hurt anybody. That was the other thing. You know, all those missed Thanksgivings, all those missed Christmases where I'm on my way and end up someplace else. You know, neighbors finding you buck naked on your front yard, you know. Here I am going from glass to aluminum on the beers to make the trash man happy. Because I'm figuring I don't want to overtax his back with my empties. But that's okay if he finds me flat my buck naked on my back on trash morning, you know, with the rain coming down, you know, and I can't wake up, or, you know, the dog's coming over and licking your face and going, this is not good, get up, get inside here. Or when you rake your front, you rake your living room of the empties. You know, normal people don't do those things. And so here I am in AA, and I really did. I thought life is over. And he starts talking about the things that have changed in his life and how his life has gotten progressively better. Not from a standpoint of things that he had, not from things that he was going to get. It's just that when he closed his eyes at night, he could sleep. And I can't do that. Because the worst thing you could do is leave me alone with my thoughts. Because I am just absolutely troubled. I have no clue on how to live life without alcohol in my body. When I started drinking, it was like a big old Ferris wheel, and I would turn that wheel, and it'd have this little sliver that said trouble. and everything else was fun. And it came up fun every single time. And at the end, I had this big old Ferris wheel, and all it said was trouble, and had this little sliver that said possibly fun. And I would shoot for that every single time. It would never come up. But I would keep spinning and spinning that wheel, hoping, just hoping one time it would come up. Because that's the way I learned to live. That's the only clue that I had. And as I told you, my sponsor had a grand sponsor. And grand sponsors are worse than sponsors, you know, your own sponsor, because they taught your sponsor what they know. You can't go around your sponsor to get to the grand sponsor. He's going to tell you the same thing. And so my first night out of recovery, I'm on my own. He says, we're going to a meeting. That's why this doesn't bother me coming down here. I live in Fairfax County. There are thousands of meetings in Fairfax County every night up there. We get in the car, and he gets on the Beltway. And I pull out my big book. And my big book at that time was the Where and When. And I'm counting off the meetings that he's driving by as we're going north. And I'm like, and I'm wondering if I should point this out to him. I was, something kept me from not doing it. And we go to this place called Harbor City up in Baltimore. And it was the old Harbor City. And I got sober in August. And Baltimore in August, it's just a pleasure. And it's just a pleasure. And it was an old church. And the first thing they tell you is get a seat by the fan. But the first thing you have to do is get through the doorway. And, you know, I need space. And they've got people, and I'm not going to fit. I'm looking at them going, I'm not going to fit. Because there are people on each side of that doorway as you got to go up. And I'm like, do not touch me. And I'm trying to get, they ain't going to go that way either. Trying to get sideways. So they're going to touch me. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks. And I get up there, and I got a seat right in front of the fan. The fan had two blades, and they were together. And it would go up like this and almost go, and go right back and just hang on the bottom. And it's like 5,000 degrees in this church. You know, clothes are going left and right. I mean, I thought it was a nudist colony after a while. I'm like, you know, don't do this. And this woman walks up to the stage. And it's the first time in my life I heard Hope. And she talked about being sober for some time and not getting things back. Because I thought, when I got sober, everything should just come back perfectly. And she talked about how it didn't happen that way. She talked about her arrogance, where in her first meeting she heard the speaker say, I have bad news for newcomers. Only one of the three of you will have any long-term sobriety. And in her arrogance, she turned to the person to the left of her and said, I'm so sorry. And she turned to the person to the right and said, I'm so sorry. She just assumed she'd be the one. And I went, you know what? That's where I'm at. But she said, it gets better. And it just gets better, and that's all I needed to hear. And back in the car, we came to Northern Virginia, and I'm willing now at this point to do anything these people say. Because it's better than what I got. It's absolutely, positively better than what I got. And, you know, and then you start seeing these small gifts come back. Just little things. Like sleep. Is there any better feeling than putting your head down the pillow at night and knowing you're going to you hope to wake up the next morning and you're not interrupted by the things we used to be. All that terror and all that anxiety and all that, this panic attacks. And just knowing that, goodness gracious, you know, it's not that bad. And then finding out I only had to have a God of my understanding. And it's interesting, that God of my understanding was the one of my childhood. But now I hear that he loves me. And that he wasn't trying to kill me. He's just waiting for me to come back. That's amazing to me. Because friends wouldn't have anything to do with me. Some family members wouldn't have anything to do with me. Why would God? But I'm just one of his kids. That's what my grand sponsor told me. When I was first trying to get this concept to God, and I was whining, never whined to your great-grand sponsor, because he's even sharper than the other two. He looked at me right in the eyes and said, yeah, your problem is, your God's 4 feet tall, and your problems are 6 feet tall. Your God is not big enough to handle your problems. You need to expand your vision of God. I'm like, well, how do you do that? You pray some more. It's got to be bigger than you. It has to be bigger than you. And after a while, when you can wake up, and I heard this story told 100 different ways, and there's knowing there's a God, and then there's having the trust and faith there is a God. And the story is told about watching the gentleman, an acrobat, getting up and up on that wire and putting a wheelbarrow on that line and going across. And he puts his wife in there. And he goes across perfectly. And then he puts his baby in there. And he goes across perfectly. And he comes down out of that stand and he says to one of the people that are amazed, "Do you think I can do it again?" And the guy says, "Of course you could do it again. I know you can. I saw you do it again. Are you sure I can do it again? I know you can. You're a professional." Then he said, "Come on up with me and get into the basket." And that's when I knew I had to have that kind of faith. Because when I don't have that, when I don't have that kind of faith, when I'm willing to let go of all my ideas and stop trying to figure things out and letting God have them, goodness gracious. And then the value of a sponsor. Someone that's gone ahead and done this for me already. You know, I can feel the bumps on his head where he's already knocked his head in the wall, or I can get my own bumps. I got my choices. Okay? I learned very, very quickly the worst thing you can say to a sponsor is, "Let me tell you what I've done." It tends not to work out well. Thousands and thousands, I didn't say thousands, no, not that important. Three people told me, "What's the problem with you and your drinking? Why won't you stop drinking?" Because it wasn't a problem for me. It's a problem for you. That's the problem. You're the problem. It's your problem. And it kind of reminds me, my sponsor currently is military, and he explains sponsorship this way. He says, you know, a mother walks into the barracks and sees her child, walks up to his bunk and sees it's immaculate, it's perfect. You could bounce a dime off that bed, and his footlocker's perfect, his boots are polished. He's sitting there in a brand shiny new outfit, and he's just ready to go. Sharper than hell. He's just a Marine. He's there. And the mother walks up to that drill sergeant and says to him, "How did you get my son to look like this? I've been trying for 18 years. And that drill sergeant looked right at her and said, "Ma'am, it's simple. You love your son, and I do not." And I'm not saying that my sponsor doesn't care for me, but he's certainly going to let my will run and let it go where it wants to go. I've stolen everything I've said tonight, so if you liked any of it, someone else said it first. But I want to share this piece that always kind of explained where it was at spiritually. But, you know, if you have kids, can they really do anything to break your heart? They can break your heart. You know they pretty much they love you because you get either a real bad drawing on Mother's Day or a stupid tie on Father's Day. So you pretty much know they love you. Okay? So you know that. And they don't love you because you're sponsoring people. They don't love you because you've been sober for the amount of time you are. They don't love you for any of those reasons. They don't care what you do or your friends that you have. They just love you because you're the mother and father. That's why they love you. But they're going to make stupid decisions. They're going to do stupid things. They're going to do things and say things that might even break your heart someday. But you'll never stop loving them. And my piece to that is, if that's happening to us here, is God a worse parent than we are? Can't be. And that's my God. My God looks at all the crap I've done and says, "I'm still here." And God has no stepkids. He has no grandkids. He just has kids. And we are all God's kids. Thanks for letting me share.